Tomorrow on Issues Etc., the Judas Gospel. Nicholas Perrin of Wheaton College will be our guest. We'll be talking about that. Is it a gospel? Did it come from Judas? Does it have anything to do with the Gospels as we know them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? All those questions answered tomorrow on Issues Etc. Well, the first time I heard this, watched this trailer for this documentary called Jesus Camp, it scared me. I admit it right here on the air. We played it for you a couple weeks back. And it deeply concerned me because I'm a father of children, so I look at these things through a father's eyes. Would I want my kids subjected to something like, you'll hear it for yourself in just a moment, something like this Jesus Camp, where they say they are training young children. We're talking about grade school age kids here. This isn't the youth group. These are the kids, the little kids, the short ones. They're training this generation of kids to be an army for God. And they're training these kids to be that generation. And this is something I didn't catch on to when I first heard it, when we first talked about it, but I did after reviewing the trailer again. They view this generation of children who undergo this program called Jesus Camp as a key generation for Jesus' return. I think they can somehow instigate the return of Christ. I don't know if they go that far, but it certainly sounds like it. Now, the documentary film, which you won't be able to see, but you will be able to hear, is this is a camp that is held for small kids. It seems to be a pretty intense experience. At one point, the kids are wearing face paint and dancing with, what is it? Is it sticks? They look like some sort of, my son does martial arts, and sometimes the older kids come in with these bo staffs, these long sticks that they use as a weapon in martial arts. And it looks like this. They're doing like coordinated movements, yelling, screaming, children crying, quivering on the floor, apparently in some sort of ecstatic spirit-led experience. So you won't be able to see that stuff, but that's what's going on. Let's listen to this trailer for a documentary that's coming out called Jesus Camp.
This is a sick old world.
Kids, you got to change things.
Boys and girls can change the world? Absolutely.
There are two kinds of people in the world. People who love Jesus and people who don't.
Speak the word of the Lord!
Where should we be putting our focus? I'll tell you where our enemies are putting it. They're putting it on the kids.
How long have you been a Christian?
At 5, I got saved.
Yeah?
Because I just wanted more of life.
You go into Palestine, and they're taking their kids to camps like we take our kids to Bible camps, and they're putting hand grenades in their hands.
There's an excitement, yet there's a peace with it all, too. It's really cool.
I really feel that we're a key generation to Jesus coming back.
And we are a generation that needs to rise up and run with that baton.
Yeah. How many of you want to be those who would give up their lives for Jesus?
We're being trained to be God's army.
Not enough!
You are the beginnings of a movement.
Raise up righteous judges!
There's a new church like this every 2 days in America.
25% of the American population, that's about 80 million people.
If the evangelicals vote, they determine the election.
They've taken over the White House, Congress, the judiciary for a generation.
This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Are you a part of it or not?
You know, even without the visuals, it's a little scary. And I've seen it a couple of times. That's the trailer for the documentary called Jesus Camp. Now, someone says, golly. What they've done is they've gone in with these documentary makers have gone in with their cameras and they've produced a very slanted view. They've selectively chosen some of the more disturbing images from this Jesus Camp program to put into their documentary to scare people, to rile up people and get them worried about it. Well, I'll tell you what, it's the kind of thing I would worry about if my kids were involved in it. I would not be sending my kid to Jesus Camp. I think there are much better things to do than teach your kid to put on camo, paint his face, and dance around with bungee sticks or whatever they are. I don't know what they're doing. I guess I'll have to watch the documentary to find out. I want to hear from you on this Jesus Camp film, and in just a moment we'll hear from the directors of Jesus Camp. They don't think it's biased. They don't think it's a slanted view. We'll hear from them in a moment. It's Audio Open Lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Would you want your kids or your grandkids to attend a Jesus Camp program? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or you can email us right here in the studio. I'll take your questions and comments via the email. issuesetc@kfuo.org. It's Audio Open Lines. As time permits, we'll also get to a PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly report on the Catholic Church and Islam in the wake of the Pope's comments and the reaction among worldwide Muslims. That'll come up a little bit later. First, let's hear from the directors of this film, Jesus Camp. Rachel Grady says that Jesus Camp, her documentary, is not a documentary with any agenda.
We wanted it to be very neutral, a neutral depiction of the people that are the focus of our film and Becky Fisher and her ministry. We did that intentionally. We thought that it would be more provocative and engaging.
Okay, now that kind of, at least they can claim anything they want to, and I don't know, having not seen the film, whether it does carry an agenda. The trailer, man, if they're doing straight news on this thing, straight documentary on this thing, with that trailer, and they're saying, let's just go in and show what happens at Becky Fisher's Jesus Camp, then it may be even more scary than I thought it was. Who knows? Grady says that the parents of children in Jesus Camp are committed Christians.
They tell their kids and they believe that their children have something to do with the second coming of Christ. And that is very empowering for a child. I think that would be empowering for an adult as well.
Now, that's one of the things that is odd about this, of course. There are two things that strike me as odd and disturbing. One is the whole image of warfare. The end of the trailer was Becky Fisher yelling, "This means war, this means war." And then the kids are wearing camo and face paint. It's hard to tell because the video isn't that great. And they look like they're handling some sort of weapons, even though I think it's a dance routine they're doing for parents who came to visit the camp. Kids crying, quivering on the floor, things like that. That's one of the things that's odd and disturbing. But the more disturbing thing to me was this kid who says our generation is key to the return of Jesus. And then Becky Fisher likening her camp to the camps that Muslims send their kids to, where they learn to burn in, you know, the president in effigy and burn the American flag and hate the West. I mean, that comparison is a bit disturbing. What do you think? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Rachel Grady, who's one of the co-directors of Jesus Camp, says that the children at Jesus Camp are being trained to make a global impact.
All of them are planning on being missionaries abroad, so they're actually going to travel all over the world.
So what are the kids being told the message as they go out to be missionaries is going to be? Now, again, it's just the trailer. We have to wait to see the film to find out, but there wasn't any mention of the central message of Christianity at this Jesus camp. There was a kid who talked about being saved at five because he just wanted more out of life. So we don't know whether the message of the cross is central. I have my doubts. I'll just say that. I have my doubts. What do you think will happen to these kids? The kids who have been through Becky Fisher's Jesus Camp, as much as we know about it, in 5 or 10 years. Will they be missionaries? Will they be the face-painted stick-carrying missionaries? Will they be missionaries? Will this be a childhood experience like so many of us had? I mean, how many of us went to camp and had some sort of life-altering experience? Or will it be a genuinely abiding commitment for them? What do you think? 5, 10 years from now, these kids who attend Jesus Camp, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Grady says that the film focuses on Pastor Becky Fisher's kids, and it's called The Kids on Fire Summer Camp in North Dakota.
what she still believes she's going to get out of it is an opportunity to spread her word. You know, she knew that we were coming from a secular point of view and from a secular world, and that when was she going to get an opportunity to spread her message and share her ministry with people that were not saved?
So Becky Fisher consents to this. She wants to use the documentary as a way of getting her message out. Now, so far of what I've seen, the message is difficult to discern. She says she's raising up children who are an army of God. At one point, one of the preachers there is exhorting the children to be that generation that will die for Jesus. Now, if you've listened to this program, you know that I'm an advocate of teaching our children, the next generation of children, preparing them for the fact that the world that they are going to be living in will be more hostile to their faith and to them and to the church than the world we live in. Now, I don't know that it will be, but we should prepare them, don't you think, for a world more hostile to their faith than the one we live in. So that 5, 10, 20 years down the line, these kids understand that part of being a Christian is going to be suffering for the faith. Now, I grew up in suburban America. I could wear my little Jesus pin, go to Sunday school, go to Bible class, go to VBS, go to church, completely unhindered and unmolested, right? That might not be the truth for our kids and our grandkids. We don't know, but it might not be. So I'm an advocate of preparing our children for what most Christians throughout history have experienced, which is real bona fide persecution. Not this inconvenience that we call persecution today, but real bona fide persecution. I don't know that I go about it doing it the way that Becky Fisher's doing it at the Kids on Fire Jesus Camp. Do we arm them with experience? You know, get them there in North Dakota for 2 weeks, paint up their faces, play lots of loud praise and worship music, yell at them, make sure that they're, you know, get them all riled up, essentially. I don't know how these kids sleep at night. Good night. Or do we carefully, slowly, methodically teach them what they need to believe in order to stand up under that persecution? I mean, the next generation, an army for God. Okay, I'm fine. Let's use that terminology. What kind of an army? An army armed with God's word, and an army armed with, boy, I remember back in North Dakota, being trained for what appears to be some sort of quasi-military operation. I don't know. Arming them with the feelings and the memories of a real on-fire summer for Jesus, where they played patty cake and said, I love Jesus, how about you? Or with the solid meat of God's word. Here's another director from this new documentary called Jesus Camp, Heidi Ewing. She says that they began this documentary project without any preconceptions about what Jesus Camp would be.
I was raised a Catholic and Rachel's Jewish, so neither of us had any negative or positive experiences with the evangelical world.
Now, that's another concern, because part of this documentary, and it was even there in the trailer, you may have recognized the voice, Ted Haggard, president of the National Association of Evangelicals, talking about how if evangelicals just voted, they control the election. How much of a connection in your mind is there between the mainstream of evangelicalism and what appears here to be something a little more on the fringe of the evangelical movement? I do not know whether Ted Haggard advocates the Jesus Camp concept. I don't know any of that. I just know he appeared in the trailer of the documentary. Ewing says that children praying in front of a cardboard cutout of President Bush were praying for him, but not to President Bush.
They said, it is in the Bible that we have to pray for those in authority above us, and that includes our political leaders. And we said, well, would you have prayed for a cardboard cutout of Bill Clinton or of John Kerry? And they said, yes, absolutely, we would.
Good. So, I mean, at least they're getting something right. Although, I don't know why you put a cardboard cutout of President George W. Bush for the kids to pray next to. These are kids, for heaven's sakes. Let's pray for mom and dad. So you put a cardboard cutout of mom and dad in the bedroom so that when the kids kneel down at night, they can... I'm all for praying for the president, whoever he may be. That's a good thing. Heidi Ewing says that the children who were sobbing and displaying this extreme emotion during the revival meetings that seemed to form a rather large part of the Jesus Camp experience explained exactly what was happening there.
What they said was that God's heart is broken because of we've let him down, and our society is vile, and people haven't come to Christ. So we are trying to feel God's broken heart, and we have to cry the tears for God.
I just don't get that. I'm sorry. Wait, first of all, have we let God down? That's an odd way of saying it. We let God down. He expected so much more of us, and we let him down. We disappointed him. God is not disappointed. His reaction to our sinfulness, not our nation let him down. God isn't watching the borders of the United States and focusing on it and saying, boy, I had such high expectations for those Americans. They really let me down. I'm disappointed. By golly, I'm disappointed. Is God sorrowful over our sin? There's no doubt about that. But it goes far deeper than simply God saying, I expected so much more out of the United States. Just let me down. And then he cries a little bit about it. No. Well, look in Genesis. God looks down and sees that all of mankind, the whole world is filled with only evil all the time. By the way, not just America and not just those who haven't come to Christ, but all the world. And he doesn't only regret that he made man, he does something about it. This is judgment. This isn't sad God weeping big crocodile tears in heaven. I don't know that God wants us crying his tears. I think he'd rather have us repent. Maybe that's what the kids meant. So what does God do about it, ultimately, when he still looks down on the world, even after the flood, and says, still only evil all the time? It goes far deeper than disappointment. What does he do about it? Well, he promised he would never again destroy the earth with water. He sent Jesus into this world to bear that sin. God didn't sit up there in heaven crying, oh, poor me, I'm so disappointed. He didn't sit up there sobbing in heaven. He sent Jesus Christ to pay the price for our sins at the cross. Finally, Heidi Ewing, the co-director of Jesus Camp, the documentary, says that the children in Jesus Camp are, well, more intense than other kids.
They definitely talk about the fact that the society isn't where they want it to be, and that a lot of people are not going to go to heaven unless their souls are saved. And there's some really heavy talk going on in these households. So it's not that they're not happy. They're not miserable kids, but they're definitely more intense and serious, I think, than your average American kid.
I don't see that there's anything wrong with this. And as long as – here's the thing – one of the other things that concerns me. The tendency of evangelicals to look outside the walls of the church or the Jesus camp, as the case may be, and say everything out there is going to hell in a handbasket. Society is corrupt. The problem is the sin out there. The problem is those sinners out there. That's the tendency of evangelicalism, especially the more political end of evangelicalism, to look out and say, you know, the real problem is society is going to hell in a handbasket. It isn't what it ought to be. Rather than, I'm going to hell in a handbasket. The sinner here is the real problem. I mean, if the pastor is preaching against the sinners out there, why are you sitting there? You can observe the sinners out there by sitting at home and watching cable. You can observe the sinners out there by turning on the news or opening the newspaper. What pastors need to do on Sunday morning, or what camps for kids need to do, is to drive home the fact that we are the problem. It's not they that are the problem. We are the problem. It is my sin, not society's sin. My sin. I want to hear from you on this issue of the Jesus Camp. It's audio, open lines, issues, etc. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 26th of September. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We've heard from the trailer. We've heard from the directors. I want to hear from you. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's start with Cindy, who calls from South County. Hi, Cindy. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. When I heard the five-year-old say that he got saved when he was five, and or the little boy say that he got saved when he was five, and then he wanted more out of life, that just hit me right between the eyes. And the more you spoke about all this, I think it's sort of like the little engine that could theology. I think I can. And what I have seen, I think that my husband and I and our children went to churches that would really have adhered to this camp, that a lot of times when you continue with this sort of message, people become real discouraged and disillusioned, and then they walk away.
That's a common story, Cindy. Thank you. That's why I asked the question. What do you think is going to become of these kids who are all fired up and all worked up at a Jesus camp 5 years from now or 10 years from now when they're too old to go to Jesus camp? Well, or this. leaders of youth groups, listen carefully, please. You go off and you give the young people, whether the little kids at Jesus camp or the older kids at some sort of youth thing, you give them this mountaintop experience where the experience is really intense. It's all packed together. They're all together. The emotions are high. The whole thing is designed to kind of concentrate these experiences and these emotions. Well, by the way, it's not just, you know, the kind of youth gatherings where the kids punch beach balls around during the worship service or listen to rock concerts under the guise of a worship service. You give them this mountaintop experience, and then they come back and they're like, golly. No matter how intense you make Sunday morning, you can't match it. So the kid spends the next 50 weeks of the year waiting to go back to Jesus camp or go back to the youth gathering, to that mountaintop experience, because he's been sold this idea that that's what the goal is. That's what Christianity really ought to be like, and anything less than that is just a disappointment. I speak from experience here. I mean, I was in a youth group once and had my fair share of the mountaintop experiences and then went back on Sunday morning like, oh my goodness, I think I'm going to fall asleep. I can't keep my eyes open. Where are the beach balls? Where's the loud guitar? Come on. It becomes something of an addiction. Or they go back and their parents aren't as on fire for changing society as they are. And they're like, Mom and Dad, I doubt you're even believers. Your phone calls, your emails on this new documentary, Jesus Camp, after this break. And then we'll hear a PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly segment on the Catholic Church and Islam in the wake of the Pope's comments and Islamic reaction. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, we're happy to take your questions or your comments right here in the studio. IssuesETC@KFUO.org. After another half hour of audio open lines, we're going to be joined by Greg Kokel, president of Stand to Reason. We're going to talk about two issues. A recent St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial, you may have seen it, called Eggs and Ethics. And Ellen Goodman has written a column on the issue of pro-choice. She's trying to explain what it means to really be pro-choice. The example she uses, though, I don't know. I don't think it works. We'll see what Greg Kokel has to say coming up in a half hour. And then in the last half hour of the program, more audio open lines. We'll try to get to another PBS Religion Ethics feature on the faith of Senator John Kerry. Stay tuned.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
President Dean Wenthy on the future of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
In every way, I can't believe the blessings that we have been given as we Lutherans say, not with any merit or worthiness on our part, but by God's grace, he continues to lead talented and dedicated men and women to give their lives to him and to the truth of the gospel. And I'd like to invite any of your listeners to come and visit us, but more than visit, worship with us, be my guest for a campus tour, and see how our life revolves around this wonderful truth that the incarnate Christ has brought to our world.
To accept Dr. Wenthy's invitation for an on-campus tour at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, Call 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Values voters looking for encouragement and energy found it at the Washington briefing last weekend in the nation's capital. More than 1,700 people from 48 states attended. Stuart Shepard was there.
An impressive A-list of conservative speakers made their best case for family values at the briefing. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow shared how his boss not only wants to defend the family from threats abroad, but also from threats at home.
This is a president who does, in fact, believe in the sanctity of the family and wants people to know that the definition ought not to change.
Dr. James Dobson explained why he sees the war on Islamofascism as a family issue.
Because if we don't have security for ourselves, for our children, for future generations, there is no future for the family.
Ann Coulter wondered aloud that if abortion is such an important constitutional right, why are supporters afraid to even say the word?
Why aren't the places where this right is exercised named after the heroes of the movement? How about the Teddy Kennedy Abortion Clinic? Chuck Schumer Abortion Mill? This is a constitutional right that even the proponents of the right don't want their names associated with.
And Sean Hannity called for an end to judicial activism.
It is imperative for the future of this country that we have politicians that know and understand the importance of putting originalist justices on the bench.
He said we live in transformational and consequential times. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard in Washington.
The goal of the conference was to encourage evangelicals to register and vote. The event was sponsored by Family Research Council Action, Focus on the Family Action, Americans United to Preserve Marriage, and American Family Association Action. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
There was a change in the room. You could sense it. You could hear it.
On the next Focus on the Family, how to teach your children about morality and character while engaging them in the culture war.
It's good when you force yourself to get out of your comfort zone a little bit, because that's your opportunity to see God at work.
Tom and Evelyn Hess share how you can make a difference in the culture on the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is actually a CD and booklet. It's titled Listening to Luther. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The CD contains a recording of Luther's Small Catechism and hymns by Martin Luther. The booklet contains a history of the Small Catechism and several of Martin Luther's hymns, including the text. Listening to Luther, our Issues Etc. book of the month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Audio Open Lines. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 26th of September. Your thoughts and your ideas, your questions, if any, on Jesus Camp. We heard the trailer before, and from the directors, they said there's not an agenda in this thing. It is simply trying to objectively describe Becky Fisher's ministry up in North Dakota, where she has a camp called Kids on Fire Camp, I think is what they call it there. And the film is called Jesus Camp. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I guess if someone says, what is this Jesus Camp thing all about? As far as you can tell, it looks to me like it's an attempt to take the typical Bible camp experience way up, not just a notch, but a whole bunch of notches. Make it that much more intense, and as far as I can tell, prepare kids for, well, she ends by saying, this means war, this means war. To be warriors in the culture war? Or is it about making them missionaries? That's not clear to me yet. Because the two are really two different things. Well, you can clean up society. You can get rid of the depravity in society. And you'll have a bunch of people who, you know, live in a clean, a squeaky clean society, still die and go to hell. Now, of course, it's not an either or, but these kids are having this very intense experience. at Jesus Camp, and one wonders, you know, you just don't toy with kids' emotions this way. Kids are very easily manipulated. Even as savvy as they are, they're very easily manipulated, especially by adults. You have kids sitting around crying the tears of God. Now, they go home, and that's what I was thinking about before we went to the break. They go home, and mom and dad, who sent them off to Jesus Camp, get a different kid home. The kid's, you know, now ready to go out and be a culture warrior or something like that. And they look at mom and dad just go to work, and they come home. And yes, they still go to church and everything. Mom and dad, they're not crying the tears of God. Mom, dad, where's your face paint? Mom, where's your camo? And they start to doubt that their parents are even believers, because the standard of what a real Christian is has been set. Kind of like when we send our kids off to the youth gatherings or whatever they are, these youth assemblies, big fancy events, they get loud music, fun. They call it fellowship, but I think it's flirting more than fellowship in huge numbers, and they get, and maybe in the best of all possible circumstances, some really good teaching, but it's all very compacted, all very concentrated into an experience. Everybody walks away feeling great. Everybody, especially the adults. They walk away feeling great. Wow. Coming down off the mountaintop, they go home, and they look at mom and dad, and they're like, hey. They seem like they're hardly Christians at all. They're not shaking in the spirit, weeping the tears of Jesus. They go to church, no beach balls, no loud guitars, pastor. It's not as charismatic as that guy we had at the youth thing, right? No. Not as funny as the guy we had at the youth thing. Not as interesting. I'm going to wonder if he's even a Christian. I don't know, maybe my concern is overblown. As I said, I do speak from experience. I went through my own mountaintop experiences and went home wondering whether my parents believed I was an idiot. I'm sorry. That's the only thing I can say looking back on it. I was a complete idiot. My judgment for my basis for judging whether or not my parents were even really Christians was, they didn't seem to share in this experience, this mountaintop experience that I'd had, or the feelings that I had. Never thinking for a moment, maybe they're just mature. Maybe they know better. Nah. I mean, that's what I said when I was a teenager. You know, people have the same thing with this radio program. They really do. I mean, we hear from people who have the same thing with this radio program. Oh, it's just, there's nothing like it. We've had people in the past email us and say, Issues, Etc. is my church. I don't get it from my pastor. It's not the same. They're kind of doing the Jesus Camp thing with this radio program. The actual ministry of preaching the word and giving out the sacraments in the local parish is where God does his thing. These mountaintop experiences, I don't know. These mountaintop experiences, I don't know who's doing what there, to tell you the truth. Where God is most certainly at work is where his word is being faithfully preached and his sacraments being administered. Which is why Jesus didn't leave us a series of mountaintop experiences. He didn't say, all right, guys, now, every year, you get together a bunch of you, okay, and all go to a big venue and call together the finest and the greatest of all speakers and the most charismatic of all teachers and great music, great worship. And every year, have a mountaintop experience. He didn't leave that to us. You know what he left to us? A bunch of frumpy, dumpy pastors and apostles who had nothing more interesting to say wherever they went than Jesus has died for you and Jesus was raised on the third day for you. He didn't leave them. Hey, guys, before I leave, here's a package of beach balls. You get busy blowing them up. Peter, you learn to play the guitar, and Thomas, you seem like a pretty good candidate for the drums. John, you sing well enough. You can be the lead singer in the praise band. No. He didn't leave any of that for us. Can it be boring? Yeah. But that's a function of my sin, not of the good gifts that Christ left with us. The only reason Christians are bored with the Word of God and with His sacraments is because Christians are sinners. And that boredom is just a symptom of them turning up their nose at the good gifts of God. Me included. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is an audio CD. And no mountaintop experience in this thing. It's pretty ordinary stuff. It's just Ken Sherb reading the words of Luther from the Small Catechism on the mundane topics of Ten Commandments, the Creed, the Lord's Prayer, baptism, absolution, the Lord's Supper. Just those good gifts that we tend to turn up our nose at as bored and sinful Christians. It's worth reading. I mean, it's worth, because the booklet is there, it's also worth hearing. It's $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and ask for Listening to Luther. 1-800-325-3040 is their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. Well, we've been reflecting quite a bit here on the Pope's comments on Islam and on the reaction of worldwide Islam. What does it all mean? Are we far enough from it now that we can get some perspective? Here's a piece from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly on the Catholic Church and Islam. It features two authors, one of a book called The Rule of Benedict, and another, what's her name? Scroll down there, Jeff, if you would. I want to make sure we get this right. She's got a book called Mecca and the Main Street, and what they're talking about is the relationship of the majority of Christians, 1 billion Catholics worldwide, and Islam. Here's the story from PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly.
More now on Pope Benedict's remarks about Islam and violence and the angry reaction by many Muslims. Genevieve Abdu is the author of the new book Mecca and Main Street about Muslims in America since 9/11. She's reported extensively from the Middle East and is now part of a UN project to improve relations between the West and Islam. David Gibson is also a veteran religion writer and has specialized in coverage of the Catholic Church. His new book is The Rule of Benedict. David, why did the Pope say what he said?
Well, Bob, that's the big question that everybody's asking. And I think the simplest answer is fundamentally that Benedict has a more skeptical, even critical view of Islam than his predecessor, John Paul II, did. And so when he introduced this rather academic lecture on faith and reason, it was almost natural for him to pull out this 600-year-old story about this emperor questioning whether Islam is inherently violent. And I think the other thing that I'd point out is that Benedict's still getting his feet as Pope. He gave that address as a theologian, which is his career, but he's got to realize that now he's the Pope, and his words can have unforeseen consequences.
Genevieve, why was there so much violence in reaction to that?
Well, Bob, actually, Muslims don't think that this is natural for the Pope to be saying these remarks at all. In fact, they believe that his whole connection between Islam and violence, that's something that he should be far more knowledgeable about and not to fall into this trap that has become sort of part of a consensus about the faith.
But do you feel that there is a connection, that there is something inherent in Islam that condones or encourages violence?
Absolutely not. The Islamic sources in no way condone violence. The militants that we now have become so familiar with that do carry out these acts of violence, in fact, they are distorting the principles of the faith. And so from the Muslim perspective, they ask, for example, why isn't Christianity during its periods of violence associated with violence? Why isn't Judaism associated with violence during its periods in its own history? And this is what was particularly sensitive for Muslims about these remarks.
It seems to many Americans, as you know, that when somebody in the Islamic world makes some violent statement or violent action, attacking a church or something like that, that moderate Muslims just don't speak out about it.
Well, in fact, they are speaking out. The problem is that they're rarely quoted in the media. So when they issue press releases, when they speak out regularly in their organizations or in their community, the world doesn't really hear from them. They just really don't have access. And of course, they hope that this is something that will change in the future.
David, the Pope has invited Muslim representatives to come talk to him on Monday. In this whole area of dialogue, does the Pope think that there can be some fruitful outcome of people talking to each other?
Well, the Pope has always been much more skeptical of the benefits of interreligious dialogue. One of his first acts as Pope was to downgrade the Vatican office of interreligious dialogue. And in fact, he sent the Vatican's top expert in Islam off to a diplomatic posting. Again, if he'd had somebody reading over his shoulder, perhaps before he delivered the lecture, none of this would have happened. But I think there's a real, there are two main issues here. There's the theological dialogue on what Islam is and how it relates to Christianity and Catholicism. And then there's the more political and diplomatic issue as to what Muslims are doing in certain countries and why there's persecution of Christians. And he's really got a lot of work to do, I think, on both sides, but he seems to have made a remarkable, for him, commitment to try and make up for this.
Now, I don't know if it's the Pope trying to make up for anything. The author there of The Rule of Benedict, David Gibson, said at the beginning of the conversation, he said, I think there are other things to point out. Another thing to point out is Benedict is still getting his feet as Pope. He gave an address as a theologian, which is his career, but he's got to realize that now that he's Pope, his words can have unforeseen consequences. The real question here is, was he telling the truth? Was the Pope speaking truthfully about Islam? Or even, let's just take for the sake of argument that this was speculation on the part of the Pope. I think that's how it's being spun most of the time by those who say, look, he didn't really mean it. He was speculating. He was making an academic, proposing something academically for consideration. Let's consider perhaps the words of this Byzantine emperor. Maybe Islam is inherently violent. I mean, if that is true, if it was simply submitted for your consideration, Islam may be inherently violent, and then the reaction is as violent as it was. Six churches burned, a nun killed. You might be on your way to answering the question, and it becomes more than simply submitted for your consideration. What I find difficult about Gibson's comment there is that I don't think the Pope would draw a line between his life as politician, which he certainly is. There's just no doubt about it. Even in the technical sense, the Pope is a politician. He's the sovereign of a nation. Vatican City is an independent nation. It has its own diplomats. It has everything a nation has, and he is the sovereign of that nation. So, yes, he is a politician, and he is a theologian, but he's one in the same. Now, do I necessarily think he ought to be? No. Do I think that's something that could use better theological distinctions? Yes, I think the whole melding of politician and sovereign and Pope into one office is a bad idea. I stand there with the general thought of the Lutheran Reformation, which said, that's not a good idea. Let's make a distinction between his authority temporally and his authority spiritually. But given the fact that the papacy is what it is, when he speaks as a theologian, the Pope is not allowed to do this. He isn't allowed to, let's just use his hats as an example. You know, he's not allowed to pull off the mitre and say, now I speak here merely as an academic, and he puts on his, like, Sherlock Holmes hat and takes out his meerschaum pipe and speaks as an academic. He's the Pope 24/7. So what he says, whether it's in an academic setting or not, yes, will it have unforeseen consequences? Of course. But we don't make this distinction between, well, he's speaking as a theologian. He needs to learn to speak more like the politician. He's the Pope, for heaven's sakes. And he's the Pope round the clock. The only issue, it's not as whether what he said was appropriate or inappropriate. It's not a question of propriety. It's a question of truth. Now, on the other side, the author of this Mecca and Main Street, Mrs. Abdo, When asked the question, do you feel that there's a connection, that there's something inherent in Islam that condones or encourages violence? Her response, typical, she says the Islamic sources in no way condone violence. The militants that we now have become so familiar with that do carry out these acts of violence, in fact, they are distorting the principles of the faith. Well, they would argue that you are distorting the principles of faith. They would argue that they're acting completely in concert with the principles of the faith. So the question really becomes, rather than just a he said, she said, let's look at those principles. Let's look at, as she said, the sources of Islam. Do the sources of Islam, in fact, condone violence? We've had Dr. Alvin Schmidt on very recently. He said, there's just no getting around it. If you look at the Quran, those earlier, more Irenic, peaceful passages of the Quran are abrogated, that is, superseded, rendered obsolete by the later passages that are decidedly more violent. You say, is Islam a religion of peace? Well, it may have started out as one, but by the time the Quran is finished, it isn't any longer. That's the best way to understand the law of abrogation, that these later passages, violent passages in the Quran, supersede those that come before that are more peaceful. All right, back to this week's PBS Religion and Ethics News weekly segment on the Catholic Church and Islam.
Genevieve, one of the issues between Christianity and Islam is why Saudi Arabia and other Muslim groups can build a big mosque in Rome, but Christians can't build a church in Saudi Arabia. Why is that?
Well, in fact, there are many churches across the Arab world, and there's a long history of Christian minorities living very peacefully with Muslims. The current tensions that we see now are actually a response to global events, to U.S. policies in all the countries that we know about. And
so
that's
it's not
really
a religious argument, it's a political argument.
Absolutely. It's not about a religious difference. It's about recent political developments, because don't forget, this history, this tension is very new. In Lebanon, for example, Christians have lived alongside Muslims for centuries. So this is really a response to global events.
I don't buy that. Okay, first of all, the question wasn't, do you have Christian churches alongside mosques? The question is, why can't they build one in Saudi Arabia? Are there Christian churches, historic Christian churches in Saudi Arabia? I'm pretty sure there are. They were grandfathered in. They still exist. By the way, many of them have been turned into mosques. Heck, go to Jerusalem, where we supposedly have, in someone's pipe dream, the three great monotheistic faiths living side by side. She says not too far away in Lebanon, Christians and Muslims just lived cheek and jowl in perfect harmony for a long time. Maybe she's forgetting the Crusades. Maybe she is. These hostilities, as she says, are not new. She says they're not new. I mean, she says they are new. And they're more fueled by global events and the actions of the U.S. in geopolitics. Look, they may be a response to what the U.S. has been doing in Afghanistan and Iraq. The latest stuff may be. But the tension between Christianity and Islam, between Islam and the West, is far from new. Go back to that Byzantine emperor. This is a question of history. Go back to that Byzantine emperor who, on the eve of having his city destroyed, sacked, and taken over by the Muslims, was smart enough to say, hey, maybe this Islam thing is kind of violent. Maybe we cannot have peace with Islam. Not the kind of Islam he faced then. Was that a religion of peace?
David, the Pope is supposed to go to Turkey on a visit the end of November. What kind of reception do you think he'll have after all this?
Well, there's a great uncertainty about that trip, and certainly what reception he will get. If you've got tens or hundreds of thousands of angry Muslims in the streets demonstrating against him, that's going to be a watershed moment, I think. The Vatican and the popes have always been seen as an honest broker, frankly, between the West and the Arab Muslim world. And if that's going to no longer be the case, I think future dialogues, which are vibrant in many areas between Catholics and Christians and Muslims, is going to be the arena for future talks and progress.
Dialogue is absolutely important, as David mentioned, but I think that now, particularly given everything that's happened over the last several years, that this dialogue has to come from a world religious leader with the Pope standing.
And with politicians involved.
And with politicians. It can't just be a dialogue about religion. It has to be a dialogue that addresses all the grievances, the political grievances that Muslims have around the world.
Genevieve Abdu and David Gibson, many thanks to you both.
All right. Now, that's I asked this question yesterday when we played the piece about the Pope having dialogue with Muslim leaders. And it was not a dialogue. It was, he invited them in. He shook their hands. He read a prepared statement. And then he shook their hands and they went home. That was the beginning of this dialogue between the Pope and Muslim leaders. She says it's got to have, it has to be a summit of religious leaders of the same stature as the Pope, which is going to be hard to do because you really only have, there is no corollary to the Pope any place else. Who are you going to call in? I mean, you call in Ted Haggard to talk with Cardinal, to talk with Bishop Benedict? And where in Islam will you find someone of the same stature of the Pope? Every imam in every mosque will say, I'll go, I represent Islam. Which Islam will the Pope talk to? Andy calls from Kirkwood. Hi, Andy. Andy, hello.
That's the reason that they have to very carefully divide up the government so between various factions in order to try to keep that from happening again.
Hey, Andy, we went to you just a little bit late. Would you start over from the beginning?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I want to hear your whole comment. I didn't get to hear your whole comment.
Okay.
Start from the beginning.
Given away my age, I can remember during the Eisenhower administration, civil war in Lebanon, and that's why they have to divide their government so carefully. The president's a Christian, the prime minister's something else, and the leader of the parliament something else. There's always been this friction in Lebanon.
Andy, thank you very much. So Andy's bringing a little historical perspective as far back as he goes. Yes, there is friction. This is what I'm wondering. Is the answer really getting the Pope to sit down with Muslim leaders? What? How would that, if you're an advocate for such a thing, how would that conversation go that would result in a situation better than it is today? Where would that conversation go? What would it consist of? If it consists of what the Pope said last week, which is, Muslims and Christians worship the same God? That's not dialogue, that's compromise. And I'll keep asking the question until I guess I get an answer, and that is, if he sits down with Muslim leaders with Islam to dialogue, which Islam will he be sitting down with? Ibrahim Hooper? President of Iran? Two very different versions of Islam at work there. When we come back from this break, Hour 3 and Greg Kokel. Greg Kokel will join us for that next half hour. We're going to talk about a St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial titled Eggs and Ethics. And Ellen Goodman says she's ready to tell us all what pro-choice really means. She says it means the ability to choose not to have an abortion, although the example she uses is kind of odd to make her point. We'll see whether or not Greg agrees on the other side of this break, and when we come back after Greg's conversation in the last half hour, more audio open lines, your phone calls, and your email.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.